Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 17th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and we've reassembled our team of experts to field your scientific questions. You know, Venus is, well, it's not considered very hospitable to life, but this week, researchers announced a finding that may change our thinking. We'll talk about that and whatever else you want to talk to. If you want to talk about science, we have people here to answer your questions. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Your call's coming up after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and if you have a science question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. On the line with us today, Barbara Brabitz at Jim Pickett. Once again, our number is 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Barb and Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray.
Yep. Hi, Ray.
Nice to have you both here again over the line. And, you know, by any measure, I would say Venus is a hellish place. But astronomers looking at the atmosphere in Venus see something that might be a sign of life. In a study published Monday, they say they found the chemical signature of a noxious gas called phosphine. And I guess on Earth, that is associated primarily with life. I thought I would throw this out to you both and maybe discuss this as we await calls. By the way, the number is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabitz, should we be excited about this?
Anytime you have alien farts in the news, I think we should be excited, Ray.
That's very good. So phosphine really is associated with life, but is there any other way that it can be made?
Yeah, sure. There are ways that they can be made, but the idea is that we know enough about Venus's geology, or at least the people at MIT know enough about the rocky interior of Venus to rule out the fact that phosphine could be made through a volcanic eruption or some such thing.
You know, phosphine can be made under extreme conditions. Apparently, it's in Jupiter's atmosphere because it can be formed deeper in and diffuse over into the upper atmosphere. But they haven't been able to figure out any non-biological way for it to be made on Venus. That doesn't mean that doesn't prove that it has a biological origin, only that no one's been able to come up with an alternative explanation yet.
You know, it's an interesting concept that the life itself, now we're talking about, I think, 800 degrees surface temperature on Venus, and it rains sulfuric acid. It's not a happy place. But what they're suggesting is, and I think even going back to the late 60s, Carl Sagan suggested, well, maybe there is microbial life in the clouds 20, 30 miles up. I mean,
Well, we have microbial life in our own clouds. There's a variety of Pseudomonas that lives in the clouds that are here on this planet. That's a bacterium. And they're actually part of how we get hailstones. They seem to be one of the nucleating surfaces at which ice can start to accumulate in order to either make rain or hail. So it's not so far-fetched to think that there are floating clouds of bacteria because we have them here on Earth.
Now, I understand that phosphine was made here. I think they used it as a chemical warfare agent in the First World War. So it can be made under certain conditions. Jim mentions that it has the signature of this phosphine has been seen on Jupiter. Why then are scientists excited about this?
Well, because there are other ways that phosphine can be made, perhaps on Venus, but not in the quantity that it was found. It's also a matter that it has to be continuously produced, because the ultraviolet radiation and sulfuric acid can destroy it in the atmosphere. So if there was just kind of one poof of phosphine sometime billions of years ago, that would all be gone. So what's kind of interesting is that it has to be continuously generated. And phosphine that's made and used chemically here on Earth, it's used in the semiconductor industry to dope silicon wafers. It's also used in some fumigation. The World War One toxic gas was phosgene, which is a lot different from phosphine. Although it sounds similar, but so phosphine is a tremendously toxic gas to oxygen using creatures here on Earth. The microbes that make it are anaerobic, that is, there where oxygen is not. Oxygen reacts with phosgene pretty quickly too.
So this stuff is found, Barb, inside of digestive tracts of, I don't know, badgers or some critters, and also at the bottom of ponds, as I understand.
Right, anywhere where there's really limited oxygen. So even within a mammal's digestive system towards the end, you can have anaerobic bacteria. Clostridium difficile, C. diff, is one of these types of bacteria that can live in your colon and cause you great distress if you if it gets out of hand. It's not unheard of, anaerobic bacteria. In fact, I'm giving a microbiology test this afternoon after this show. We'll have some anaerobic bacteria on display. So it's not impossible. The thing about Venus that I think colors are thinking a lot, especially in chemistry, is that there's no free oxygen on Venus and there's very little water. So if you take those two really violent chemical reaction options out, it's possible for phosphine to exist. It's not 800 where they're looking to or seeing this phosphine signal. They're only seeing the phosphine signal in this so-called cloud deck, which is about anywhere from 10 to 30 miles up in the atmosphere, where temperatures are much more like 30 to 200 Fahrenheit rather than 800 or 900 Fahrenheit.
Right. As I understand it, too, there are tiny amounts of water up there. But is there anything, and we have to take a break here in a moment. It's the Science Forum. Barbara Brabets here, Jim Pickett here, and they will answer questions about science, not just about life on Venus or the potential for it. So if you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551. But is there anything in your knowledge, Barbara or Jim, that can live in sulfuric acid?
Yes, we have discovered extremophiles, for lack of a better name, microbes usually, that have adapted to the very rich environment of the vents in the seafloor or within the rim of a volcano or even within the pools of Yellowstone. So these extremophiles, We thought everything kind of had to be just right, but we've now learned that as long as there's an energy source of some sort, it looks like we can have adaptability within biologic systems to the point where they can live in these extreme systems.
All right, let's take a quick break. Barbara Brabets is here, Jim Pickett is here, and we will hit the Science Forum phones at email bag in a moment. 800-348-2551 is the number. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and we'll get to the phones in just a minute with Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett. One email here, though. This one's from Mark. Mark says, why are there no polar bears in the Antarctic? Well, what would happen if we introduced polar bears to that part of the world?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Polar bears' main diet is are seals and sea lions. And there are pinnipeds, the seals and sea lions, that live in the Antarctic. They're pretty extreme conditions, and the other thing that polar bears rely on is pack ice, to be able to have that pack ice break up at a certain point, but also be penetrable, because what happens is these seals and sea lions create breather holes, and often they will hunt right at a breather hole, wait for somebody to come up, and then grab them and have their meal. Often we think of penguins as part of polar bear dinner, and that is not true. That's not been their particular fare. I understand not a lot of animals eat penguins. They're a really strong flavor, but please don't send me any penguin in the mail.
Or no recipes for penguin, too. All right, that's good. All right, well, one thing I saw years ago with my kids, we were watching a special on dinosaurs, and the fossil records, apparently, there were all kinds of dinosaurs there at one time, so it was a much more livable place millions of years ago.
That's true. It's one of the world's deserts. We think of it as very snowy and certainly very cold, but they get less than 1 inch of precipitation a year. And so that's really hard to keep a biological structure intact. Most of the biology of Antarctica surrounds the continent of Antarctica in the waters around it that are very rich in nutrients.
All right, let's take a call or two here. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Baba, this is Chris calling in, Tom. You said a few minutes ago on your thing that aliens could live on Mars and things like that. And if humans started to travel to Mars, wouldn't the humans kind of be suspicious of seeing an alien for the first time on a different planet in our universe? And, you know, I sure wouldn't want to run into an alien if I chose to go to Mars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And things of that nature.
Right. But, well, that's a philosophical question, you know, to some extent, but we'll run it by our science panel. Well, I should point out that we're talking about the possibility of the signature of microorganisms in the clouds of Venus. But I'll throw your question out to our scientists. Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, well, if there's any life on Mars, it's probably microbial beneath the surface. So it's not like there's going to be little green men with their blasters out reading anybody landing on Mars. But, yeah, if humans did encounter alien life on a technology level like our own, for one thing, it might be very hard even to recognize it. It's not going to be like Star Trek and the science fiction movies.
How do you know?
Where everybody is vaguely humanoid. It will be something very different.
Yeah, as far as the biochemistry goes, we don't know if our biochemistry is unique, if DNA is really the only genetic material. DNA and RNA are the only genetic material that can be transmitted from one generation to another. There are researchers who are trying to create from scratch biologically viable genetics that have no basis in DNA and RNA, and so that we could create a synthetic life form in theory, not in practice, because that wouldn't necessarily be so smart. So I agree with Jim. We may not be able to recognize physically what we see. The hope is that our ability to analyze that life form would allow us to see if A, cells exist, if the idea of biology and chemistry contained within a membrane is intact. And then if we recognize any of the central processes that we see in biochemistry in all living things, and is that something we can rely on or not? I mean, that is a bit of a philosophical question, but at a certain point, it becomes a question of science as well.
Chris, thank you very much for the call. It's the Science Forum today. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabets join us today to answer your questions. Bob in Boysville. Bob.
Hi, good afternoon, folks. I have a not so much a biological question, but orientation. How was it determined with the Earth that north is north and south is south? Why not the opposite? Does it have something to do with the orientation of the Earth to the sun? And I'll take it on the radio.
Thanks, Bob. Okay? Okay. Who wants that one?
Well, it's simply the way we named it. North can be named anything. It's just the direction toward the North Star.
Well, yeah, and one other thing would be our magnetic alignment. The idea ever since the Iron Age that you can have an alignment of a needle on a surface that's in a direction. That's really like what you think of in like a modern day compass. That alignment in one orientation with two points, one towards that orientation and one away from that orientation. That's really where the north-south came from. There are certain cultures on islands, for example, that don't have an east and a west. As a culture, they never developed that, but they always had a north and a south. I always found that fascinating.
That is fascinating. And I remember years ago seeing a world map on the wall that all the continents were upside down. It just changed your perspective a little bit. And it was, for a moment, it was unnerving. And then it was very cool to look at. You ever see that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
It's kind of from the New Zealand perspective.
Yes, indeed. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Science Forum today with Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabets. Aaron writes, and I love this. Aaron writes, what are the chances that any potential microbial life on Venus is contamination from Earth when we send space probes there?
Chances are it wouldn't be from space probes, but one of the articles that I've read postulates that it is not inconceivable that it could have been seeded from Earth, from meteor impact on Earth rolling up rocks containing microbes and landing on Venus. This life being transmitted through space concept is often or sometimes used to postulate the origin of life on Earth, that it came from somewhere else. But Earth could also do other planets. Now, the government space probes that have come from the United States or Soviet Union that went to Venus would have been well sterilized before they go into the atmosphere. And I don't think an American probe has actually landed on Venus. So it's been well above it in orbit. But for example, the landers that are sent to Mars are carefully sterilized.
Barbara.
I would say that we also have other interplanetary taxis called comets. And there is a body of theory that believes that comets could be kind of like the dirty shoes that walk around the solar system and move these either organic carbon or moving these actual cells from one place to another, and whether they succeed or not. Is really just a matter of the odds of it working. I mean, you think about how we populated Hawaii as a species. How many boats had to leave Fiji and New Zealand and then strike out towards the middle of the ocean and didn't hit their mark, right? So all you need is one good, successful hit, and then the conditions just right, the so-called Goldilocks theory, that it has to be just right for it to happen. Now, in the past, we thought the Goldilocks theory ruled out Venus. But what these researchers are saying is that there's a very strong maybe that Venus has all the goods necessary to do this. The other thing that we didn't mention before is the phosphine levels on Venus are about 1,000 times higher than we have here on Earth. Yes, we have oxygen, which phosphine reacts with here, but we're not talking about a little bit. It's quite significant.
How did they never see it before?
They never looked, believe it or not. This is they developed phosphine as a, it could only come from biologicals marker. And we are looking with our telescopes out into space outside our solar system. And they happen to turn it around and look at Venus and go, oh, huh. But here our nearest neighbor might actually have it. It's kind of like a palm to the face, like nobody thought to look. We went outside the solar system to try to look at these extrasolar planets and say, is there any life out there? And really, there's somebody tapping us from behind.
Very interesting. Yeah. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The Science Forum with Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabets. Kevin is in Albany. Kevin.
So, I'm wondering how the fires out west with all the smoking fog might be affecting migratory birds.
Did you catch that, scientists? He's on a speakerphone, and he sounds like he's about 48 feet away.
It was about how the
fires are affecting migratory birds, basically.
Well, the migratory birds are peaking right now. So this week in the Northeast, anyway, because I'm a birding aficionado, and I've been monitoring the bird. You can watch the radars at night and see the birds migrate. It's super cool when the weather is clear like this. And they've had some serious challenges. Yes, the wildfires have affected them, especially in the Pacific Flyway, where they need to stop off in Northern California to refuel as they go from Alaska to Central and South America. For those species who can make it a little bit further to Southern California, they may just not be as impacted as those that need to go to Northern California. But the hurricane in and of itself, Hurricane Sally, has been a big bird killer. Of course, it's a natural effect. Certainly, perhaps bigger and more frequent hurricanes from climate change. But the birds are getting caught. They leave here when the weather's nice and there's not a lot of wind, unless it's favorable. And then they get down south and they get stuck in a hurricane. So it's been a rough week for birds this week. Yeah.
Okay, Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. I don't know if either of you have seen the sunrise or the sunset the last couple of days. My family brought this up, and I don't know if it's true or not. Is the smoke that's from the West Coast fires causing a filtering effect? Because the sunrises have been a little spooky the last couple of days.
Yeah, that is the smoke from the west. Yeah.
Wow. It's amazing. Yep. And is it just, I remember hearing a story or some seeing some data about the 1950s atomic tests and how basically there was almost a beeline, a jet stream that took all of that fallout and brought it over the Northeast. Is that what we're seeing here?
It's the same idea. Same as also with volcanoes. When we have these large eruptions of volcanoes, we get the same effect where the ash is really distributed via the jet streams. The weather brings it, and our weather comes from the west for the most part.
So even though, Jim Pickett, we are a couple of thousand miles away, when that big super volcano blows out west, we will have some very bad effects out here in the Northeast.
I would imagine so. We will know when it happens.
I hope we won't know. I hope it'll be a long time from now. Let's go back to the phones. Adrian and New Paltz, you're on.
Hey, hi there. I'm a UFO kind of interested, not a nut, but I'm always interested when I see certain UFO stories. I wonder if your guest had any interesting tidbits from our wonderful secret, Area 51.
Oh, well.
You know, captured technology, different weather patterns caused by their activity, entities, you know, bodies in the freezer at Wright-Patterson Air Base in Ohio, anything they'd like to share with us.
Wow.
Believe me, anything would be better than what we're putting up with these days. Right, Ray?
Well, I don't know. The show isn't that bad. All right, Jim, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, I am a very much of a UFO skeptic. It's never aliens. I just have no belief in it at all. There's very little to support it.
All right, and Barbara, have you been to Area 51?
I have not been to Area 51. I tried to, when I was in New Mexico, I tried to get to Area 51, but believe it or not, it was actually excluded from my rental car agreement. It said, in particular, I was not to go to Area 51.
You're kidding me.
You know, the scientist in me really was like, oh, really?
That is fascinating.
But I did not get there, no.
Well, Adrian, thanks for that very interesting call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab one more call before our next break, and then we will reconvene on the other side of that. Let's go to Steve in Del Mar. Steve.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody. I just have a quick question. I'll let you respond. Our guests could give us some kind of update as to the status of anti-gravity, artificial gravity and solar and cosmic radiation protection for space travelers. And I'll listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve. Who wants that one?
Well, the only thing that could be done for artificial gravity is rotating using centrifugal force. And to do that, you need a fairly large structure in order for that to be effective. If you try to spin something small, your feet may get planted onto the, what looks like the floor, but your head will be at a different gravitational, or different forces will be on your head. So that doesn't work very well. You need a large circumference.
It's funny. Go ahead.
So for any of the things that are proposed, like to go to Mars now, would be way too small to do that.
That's
and there's no other way to do artificial gravity.
This idea of centrifugal force, it goes back to 50s sci-fi movies. I mean, you see the satellites out there, huge spinning wheels. And so
exactly.
Go ahead.
The space station in 2001, A Space Odyssey, is a great example of that, where you need a fairly big structure to have enough circumference to make palatable artificial gravity. The radiation is another big problem.
Yeah, the cosmic rays, that's a different one.
Yeah, because in order to protect from the radiation, you need the equivalent of, our atmosphere basically provides the equivalent of like 3 feet of lead, okay? So you need substantial stuff to block radiation, and I don't think that.
Well, there is probably an alternative, Jim. That the Crater Telescope, the cosmic ray telescope that's steered by the moon, they have been looking at certain plastics that are kind of sacrificial anodes, if you will, that you can use plastic as a cosmic ray absorber. And the plastics will break down slightly when they absorb a cosmic ray, but that leaves anything on the other side protected, at least for the duration of the life of that plastic. And so that's much lighter than lead and other metals that could allow life forms to travel in places unprotected by cosmic by other means.
All right, to tell you what, let's take a quick break here. Jim Pickett is here and Barbara Brabets. It's the Science Forum. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets is here to answer your questions, and Jim Pickett is here as well. Once again, that number is 800-348-2551. Before we get back to the phones, Barbara, how are things going with the remote learning at Kobe, and are you teaching any classes in person?
Right, yes. I have both remote and in-person classes. I'm teaching four classes this semester. One of them is remote. That's a lecture.
Right.
That's organic chemistry. And then I have three labs. Both, all of them are microbiology, and those are all face-to-face. And even the organic chemistry students that I have lecture with remotely have to come in for lab with a different professor. And I really think the students enjoy the face-to-face interactions. I think the remote learning is a great compensator. Technology helps, but there's nothing like that social aspect of seeing people. Because, you know, as faculty, we relay information, but we're also often their experts to help them identify a field that they're interested in. Those take conversations. And, you know, Zoom in an hour and a half time span or whatever you're in for class is not really the time to say, so what do you want to be when you grow up, you know, but lab is. So I'm really happy that I have a mix of both remote and face-to-face, and I hope we continue to do well. As far as our campus goes, we've had, I think it's three COVID-positive people in the last 5 weeks, and they've all been quarantined and isolated, and I think our protocols are working really well.
Good. You know, it's funny, though, this whole technological leap that occurred in March, and the teachers are learning, the students are learning, the parents are learning. And last night, you know, I got a bunch of kids, and we've been to a bunch of open houses. Last night, my wife and I did a sixth grade open house all through Zoom. It was the best open house. I could sit on the couch. I had a cocktail and did the open house. It was fantastic. It was one of the best I've ever seen. There were some technological glitches here and there. Every now and then you saw the face of a parent who might have also been having a cocktail. And there were some hilarious moments. But I like the way everybody has adapted to this. It's incredible, isn't it?
Well, it's incredible, but I'm going to put my plug in because I often do this. Broadband is not universal in upstate New York, and I have to drive to work in order to hold a remote session. So that's not the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be at 100% penetration of broadband in upstate New York, but that just isn't the reality. And I think what will happen is the technological divide will really split apart even more as we continue to say, you know what, this was really great. Let's do it. Because it, when it works, it's terrific. And when you don't have access, it's enormously frustrating.
Well, you make a great point, but I think that in order for it to work, that might in fact have to be a role where government steps in and says, okay, we got to make sure everybody's on this playing field. Maybe it's not a completely level playing field, but everybody's on the field. So we'll see how this is all very much a work in progress, as is this program. Let's go to Michael in Olive Bridge. Michael, you're on.
Hello. I've just got a question here. I'm sure I'm missing something here, if you can straighten it out for me. I understand the universe is expanding and galaxies are moving away from each other as space expands. And I was wondering if you could explain to me, why do galaxies collide, if that's the case? Hello?
Because galaxies that are fairly close together, the gravitational force is more important than the expansion of the universe. For example, our nearby galaxy of Andromeda and the Milky Way are approaching each other.
Right.
Because they're close enough to do so. The expansion is on a larger time, a larger space scale than that.
Larger, I understand. Yeah.
All right, so, Michael, thank you. Go ahead, Jim, finish it up.
It's like, for example, our galaxy itself isn't getting any bigger because it is gravitation bound to itself. So gravity keeps it from expanding.
All right, let's go now to Vern. Vern is in Lee, Massachusetts. Go ahead, you're on.
Yes, hello. My question is regarding the lack of evidence of rotation of the Earth. I don't understand why we don't experience, you know, plane travel shorter in one direction than the other. And wondering if you could speak to that.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, you see the sunrise and the stars move. Isn't that evidence that the Earth is turning?
No. No, right, it's just evidence that you see movement.
I see. Let's go to the scientists.
How about the fact that the toilet water goes in a circle as it goes down?
What do you think, Vern?
Yeah, I don't think that's evidence that the Earth is spinning.
Jim?
How about the fact that our high-pressure and low-pressure systems are always curved?
Well, okay, I'm not sure what that means, but if you want to talk about high pressure and low pressure, why doesn't the Earth's air pressure go to lower pressure that's known, that's said to be space?
Because gravity holds the air down.
There's the weight of air, right?
Gravity holds the air down?
Yeah.
Is there air attracted to your surface?
That's why the pressure goes down as you go up.
Okay, so what about a helium balloon?
Ah, well,
I don't think the problem here is that of evidence. I think the problem is whether the people who are skeptical about the Earth being spherical, whether they trust what science has shown. And if you don't trust the fact that people do know things and have figured this out, then there's really not a lot of point of discussing it.
Vern, I'll let you get one more word in here before we go move on. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I would, it isn't a matter of trust. If evidence was there, then great. But there is no evidence that the Earth spins or that it's even a globe. You can see much further than the trigonometry tells you. If the Earth is the certain radius it tells us, then we should only be able to see so far the horizon, this Earth would dip away. Well, you can go to the seashore and see for miles. There's evidence you can see for over 100 miles. Well, it wouldn't be the case if the Earth is the shape and size that we're told. That's the fact. You can go to the shore and use binoculars and see Earth. Yes, go ahead.
Gotcha, Vern. Go ahead, Barb.
Yeah, only if they're away from the surface can you see them for 100 miles. If you're going from surface to surface, it's just over 15 miles. It's all you can see.
Well, we
got to move on. That's measurable. Everybody can do that.
Vern, thank you very much for the call. Jim Pickett and Barbara Brabets join us today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Where was I? Oh, let's go to Roman in Queensbury. Roman, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. You're on.
Good. I'm trying to find out how old the water is I swim in. I swim in Lake George, which is, you know, a glacial lake, and it's 300 feet deep in spots. And I'm wondering if I'm swimming in some ancient water or revolutionary war water.
That's a great question.
Oh, boy. It's a great question.
Anybody have any idea how old the water is I'm swimming in?
I have no idea.
Yeah, well, the last glacial retreat in New York was about 9,000 years ago. So the carving of that would have been with the glacial retreat. So, but the question is, like, what is the age of any water molecule? Water's been around for 4 billion years, 4.8 billion years. Some water is newer water, but I think on the scheme of things, we're talking about tens of thousands of years. In my water chemistry course, we talk about the recycling of water globally, because, of course, there's water that goes into Lake George, there's water that leaves Lake George by evaporation, and, you know, water usage and so on, and its natural outlets. So on average, and it's a big error bar, on average, any drop of water to get from one place and then come back to that same place is about 37,000 years.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's on a time scale of 5 billion, that's not that long. But when you're thinking about, is that same water molecule something that touched a fish that was eaten by a pioneer? It's a good chance.
That's really cool. All right, let's go to Bruce and Phoenicia. Hello, Bruce.
Hi. So I heard a broadcast yesterday on CBC about the orcas in and around the Straits of Gibraltar. And they've been very aggressive. They've been attacking boats, which is unheard of. And one of the theories is that they're stressed out to the point of extinction from shipping, and their young have been dying in childbirth for quite a while. So that they actually, since they're intelligent, are actually becoming aggressive. They're angry. And it's one theory. So what do you think about that? I don't know if you're familiar with that, what's happening there.
Barbara.
Well, I don't think orca have been in the Mediterranean for very long. Most, in fact, if I cheat and I actually Google this.
That's okay.
Yeah, it turns out that the orcas showed up 2 years ago. So they could have depleted the resources of the Mediterranean relatively quickly.
Oh, I'll be darned. All right.
They're apex predators. So they move into a new environment. They're going to take out what they eat pretty quickly.
Well, that's a great call.
Most orcas are in colder water.
Bruce, thank you very much. Jim Pickett is here. Barbara Brabets, and it's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551, the number. Nick is in Woodstock. Nick, go ahead.
Hey, I did not expect to be on the radio right now.
Well, you called, right? So you're on.
Yeah. And I've been listening to the whole show, and I'm sort of bridging it back to the topic of the gases in Venus.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Earth is round, by the way.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, I think that's been pretty much shown. But anyway, so basically, like, so these gases we have here on Earth are also there. How close to we are figuring out, you know, if it is like a tardigrade or some sort of microbacterial thing, or basically, like, I don't know how to sum it up in words, but.
Well, that's kind of a bad turn of events.
Barbara.
Well,
how do we compare what we know there to here? Is it so unknown, like the deepest part of the ocean, or is it so, you know, is it like, what is our spectrum of it, basically?
Exploring the atmosphere of Venus is going to be harder than exploring the deepest part of the ocean. But the next step is to try to put probes there that can float around in the atmosphere. And I think that's been proposed even before this, that basically you put a balloon into the atmosphere of Venus and explore it that way.
Yeah.
So that's what would have to be done to get a closer look and perhaps return samples.
And I think they're talking about maybe doing that before 2026, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. And the challenges are that the clouds that we're talking about are kind of like two-layer bubbles. The inside of the bubble is almost pure sulfuric acid. And then the outside of the bubble is carbon dioxide. And there's some talk, although it's speculation, that it's probably at the interface of these two areas in this cloud deck, which is where the chemistry would be right to be able to have life. Again, 4 weeks ago, the presumption was it was too harsh to have life. But, you know, here we are talking about it now. I think the publication that's coming out this week, it's actually coming out on the 20th, talks about all the things they did to rule out other causes. Like, okay, phosphine is there. We know it's there. And we think it's a biological marker, but what else, like, spectacularly could it be from? And can we rule that out on Venus? And that's really what the article is about. One of the other things they could do, which would be cheaper than sending a probe rather than look for cells, is look for other biomarkers that we know come with life but also have other origins. And so if we find, you know, the top 10 biomarkers of life, including phosphine, then you have enough evidence to send a probe, in my estimation.
Yeah. And the other thing is that so far we've they've been able to rule out everything they can think of. After it's published, then you've got a whole lot more people thinking about the problem. And it may be a matter that someone figures out chemistry to generate the phosphine that doesn't require life. And that's one of the reasons why scientists publish work, so that it can be looked at by a wider part of the scientific community.
And while those of us who are not scientists get very excited about this, one of the co-authors of the study said, it's not even a smoking gun, it's not even gunshot residue on the hands of your prime suspect, but there's a distinct whiff of cordite in the air, which may be suggesting something. So
yes.
There's a scientist for you. He's not jumping to conclusions.
Yep.
Well, yeah. In fact, on my paper, I wrote resounding maybe.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's good. We'll take that. And thank you both for being here, Barbara Bravitz and Jim Pickett. We'll see you next time, okay?
Okay.
Sure thing.
Thanks very much. Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years, QFCC.com. And the Hyde Collection, featuring two new exhibits, J.S. Woolley, photographer, and Images of the People, Russian Lacquer Painting by appointment only, HydeCollection.org. Once again, thanks to Barb Rabbits and Jim Pickett for being here. Thank you for listening. We appreciate the calls very much. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Amber Sickles. It's very rare to get a star answering the calls today, but Amber Sickles was here taking the call, so thank you very much for that. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow we grill and we barbecue. Well, actually, we don't, because the guests aren't in the studio, but we'll pretend to grill, we'll pretend to barbecue, and, you know, who knows how it's going to work out. Join us tomorrow at 2. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.